Tom. The X-37B, yeah, that's what they call it. It successfully came back. It was in space for almost 2 years. This December would have made 2 years. What this thing looks like, Dick, it looks like a small space shuttle. It's a, you know, one of these lifting body deals. It's unmanned. It's the third time it's flown. As far as we know, there's two of these vehicles. There might be more. It's a, you know, top secret type of thing. This was the first one that flew up a couple of few years ago and stayed up there for, I think, 6 to 8 months. And came back, landed in Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Then they had a second one go up for a longer period of time. And then they put this one back out. And they put it on top of an Atlas V rocket, one of our big rockets, down in Florida. They launch it from Cape Canaveral. It's got fairings around it, so you can't see it when it's on the launch pad. It just looks like a big old rocket going up. And then fairings separate, and the thing goes up, goes off and does its secret mission. It's got solar panels that come out. I'm going to watch the timeouts. And right now, I don't know of another flight that's planned, but if it is, the military is not going to tell us. This is an Air Force project. And, you know, these space things that are going on are not coming out of the NASA budget, by the way, so it's, that's always a good thing. You know. They've been cut, I think, 15 or 20% last year. NASA has been. So when I see these missions going up, unrelated to NASA, it's okay. Not killing their scientific budget or anything like that. We need to see some of these future missions that we keep talking about on the net come to fruition. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so this is a lifting body spacecraft. I think if I understand correctly, it was up there for 2 years, and it came down and landed successfully at in California, Vandenberg. Make a guess, Paul. What do you think that mission was doing? Over to you.
Well, I guess Rich probably read the same thing as me. As far as they know, they know it's low altitude, probably a couple hundred miles up. They know that because amateur astronomers around the world look for these things. And they've plotted where it is by what they've seen. That's about all we know about it. We know it's probably in a lower inclination from what they've seen. So we know it's not flying over Moscow, for instance. Probably over the Mideast. That's my guess. It probably sits there and does whatever it's doing. We don't know. We just know it's unmanned. If it was, I mean, the guy would have to have a lot of food in there for almost 2 years, two months short of 2 years. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to guess that the thing was also launched from Vandenberg. Vandenberg is usually used for polar orbit operations. So if this was a polar orbit craft, then it literally covers the whole darn Earth. You just
Florida, Dick.
So it was launched from Florida, but landed at Vandenberg. Isn't that a fairly unusual combination?
Well, they didn't want a polar orbit, so they launched from. They didn't, you know, you're saying a polar orbit. They did not want a polar orbit. It was probably a low inclination, probably 20, 30 degrees. Not very high, so that doesn't bring it over to Moscow. It's probably, you know, closer to the equator. And then, yes, it all three flights landed in Vandenberg Air Force Base. So you could look that up on YouTube. They showed a landing, which is pretty, actually, you can look at the launches, too. But the landings are pretty good. I mean, this thing is coming in like a rocket, man. I mean, it really is coming in like a rocket. It looks like it's coming a lot faster than a space shuttle. I'm not sure, maybe because it's small or something. But it's only, what, 30 feet long or something, some number like that. You know, maybe 25-foot wingspan. It's not a big space plane. It's nothing like the, maybe one-sixth of the size of a space shuttle, something like that.
I think our best guess is that this thing is unmanned, because to be up there for 2 years, the renewables would never allow you to do that unless somebody's visiting it every month or so. So this is an unmanned, radio-controlled thing that aims to the runway at Vandenberg, sets down his landing gear, and does a nice landing as a remotely piloted unmanned vehicle. That's a good trick. Is that what we think took place up overhead?
Oh yeah, now we know, and that's written in stone. Yes, and they've done it 3 times with 2 different vehicles.
I think that this is one of the very few times that anything has come back from space and landed on a runway as an unmanned vehicle. Am I wrong on that one, Paul? Go ahead.
I bet the shuttle could have done it, but it didn't. That was always manned. The only other one that has done it was the Bronx. One time from Russia. That was their version of the space shuttle. It went up unmanned, a few orbits, I think 4 orbits or something, and they brought that one back safely, landed completely unmanned. You're going to see another vehicle eventually, the Dream Chaser being built by Sierra Nevada, which will go up either manned or unmanned. The first flight is 2 years from now. It's November in 2016, and that's the Dream Chaser. They still have a contract with to launch on an Atlas V, the same rocket that this X-37B is being launched on, and they're going to put this thing into orbit, and it's going to come back all by itself, completely unmanned. So you'll see it. That to me should be pretty exciting. This, eventually that thing will be manned. Or, they have plans to do both with that vehicle, either unmanned flights for private or government or manned flights with the Dream Chaser. And it looks like about maybe a little smaller than about the same size, but maybe a little smaller than the X-37B.
Now that I haven't known before, at least I don't remember hearing it, that the Russian equivalent of the International Space of the Space Shuttle, which is a really big craft, our Space Shuttle was $2 billion a copy. And if theirs was similar size or maybe even a little bit larger, it's an expensive piece of hardware. To send that up unmanned and bring it back by remote control, boy, you're putting an awful lot of faith in that remote control. You get a hiccup in that control system, and $2 billion worth of hardware with an awful lot of speed and weight come down in some place that you don't like. Boy, that's quite a risk. I don't think NASA would ever put up something that big and that valuable as a remotely piloted vehicle. What do you think, Paul? KQLIW?
I think they would if they want, but there's no reason for it. And they sure could, but they haven't done it. Like I said, I think the shuttle was probably a step away from being able to land by itself. That thing needs to come back down completely, autonomous practically. And so the very end, the pilot would take over in the last minute or two. And Well, actually, it was the pilot never got the job. It was the commander's job, so the pilot was on board. But the commander grabbed the whole of this thing last minute or two and took that thing in for a landing. But, yeah, the Russians did that. And theirs was slightly bigger. And they had an enormous Energina rocket booster. The whole first stage. What a rocket that put this thing up there. It was a monster. You got to Google that thing. Put it in the bronze and a Gina and see what comes up. What a big rocket they had.
When the space shuttle takes off, it was something like 4 million pounds of mass and 6 million pounds of thrust, round numbers. So if the Soviet equivalent of the space shuttle was larger, are we talking about more than 6 million pounds of thrust, Paul? Go ahead.
For 5.5 million pounds of thrust, I remember, on the space shuttle. 7.5 million pounds of thrust on the Saturn V moon rockets. And this thing was probably 6.5 million. I'm going to stretch my memory, but it was more than the space shuttle system. So, but we got them all blown away with the SLS system coming up, the space launch system. That's going to be more powerful than the Saturn V. So, you can't fool around with us. Back to you, Dick.
I wish I knew what I was reading. I don't think it was Smithsonian. I don't think it was Scientific American. It may have been the latest issue of New York Times, Sunday Magazine. Anyhow, one of them gave a further description of what happened with Apollo 12. Everybody remembers Apollo 11. Everybody remembers Apollo 13 because of the failure. But Apollo 12, very few people remember it. But what was significant about Apollo 12, I'm vaguely remembering now, it was a advertisement for the circuit breakers. The company that built the circuit breakers is claiming that it kept them alive because 36 seconds after launch, Apollo 12 got directly struck with lightning. Lightning struck the tip of that aircraft. The current flowed down the skin of the hold-on aircraft and then out of the rocket tail, which is an ionized path, and then into the ground. So it had a direct hit 36 seconds after launch. They reset some circuit breakers. Some things got damaged. And then it got hit again with lightning 52 seconds after launch. Again, a direct hit. And some further damage occurred. But still, the mission didn't have to be aborted. But circuit breakers had to be reset because all three oxygen converters to give you power, why can't I think of the name of those things, all three of those were knocked offline and they were down to the battery pack during the launch until they reset those circuit breakers. So I wasn't familiar until I read that article a couple days ago, or was it today? I wasn't aware of how close Apollo 12 came to a rather
repeater. Time out.
Looks like I've lost the eastern input. Let me let the machine drop. Yeah, the eastern input hasn't come back yet, although maybe it's got a time delay. But as I was saying, Paul, until I read that article, I wasn't realizing how close to a disaster Apollo 12 was. Back to you for some comments on that. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, Apollo 12, it was lightning. They shuttled going all the way down the ground, it looks like, from the, there were pictures of that. But that was a P-Comrade. He was a commander. And Alan Bean, they were the two that wound up eventually walking on the moon. Third and fourth man. And P-Comrade was under control. It would have been his job to pull the D-ring. I guess they have the D-ring still in the Apollo spacecraft. And then that would have created an abort. And they had a tractor-type pulling system that, that would have pulled them away from the booster if they hit that button. But with all the circuits going, circuit breaking, things shutting down, there was one guy in mission control that, you know, knew about resetting this stuff. And he mentioned that, you know, what they had to do and what they had to push. And Alan Bean spent so much time in the simulator, and they all did, but he loved all the stuff. He remembered where this one thing was that this one guy in mission control mentioned. He was the one to push these buttons, and he actually by having a good memory for what this guy was talking about, he was able to reset whatever they needed to reset. The details I've forgotten, although I've read them in the past, but they have a rough idea what went on. Alan Bean pulled him out of the hole. He's quite a character, and today he's a very good painter. He paints beautiful space pictures. He's a really good painter. And P-Comrade, unfortunately, he died on a motor.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It was Holly. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed that the Eastern Machine hasn't come back to life. So the people who listen on the Eastern Machine are not hearing anything. And I'm not sure, John, you may know, when the Eastern Machine is not working, does that mean that the people on Echolink no longer hear the output of the TechNet, KC2WGB, K2RIW?
No, Dick, I think they still can. We could check with Rich. Maybe he could fill us in on that. But I think they do.
Yeah, K2UPS, are you hearing us even though the Eastern Machine on Long Island is off the air right now? K2UPS, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2UPS, yes, Dick, we hear the audio from it. Even if anybody times out, we hear it. It still comes through here. The only thing we do not hear is anybody coming in IRLP, like the Canadian station. That does not come through, but we hear everything else.
Okay, that's good news, but now run this by again. If the Eastern Machine is off the air, does that mean the link to IRLP is interrupted? At least in one direction, if not both directions. Back to you, Rich.
That I have no idea, because we don't hear IRLP even when everything is working. So if IRLP goes off when the Eastern Link goes off, that I could not tell you. I hear people when they transmit on the Eastern Link, I hear people on Echo Link, and I hear everybody else. Even if the repeated times out, we still hear it. But the only thing that we do not hear is the IRLP stations. That's it.
Under normal circumstances, a person on Echo Link is going by RF from his handy-talkie, so to speak, into a local repeater, and that local repeater has been aligned in such a way that it's connected to the IRLP, to the Echo Link node. But you're not going in to a local repeater. I think right now you're going in by way of a cell phone link. I guess I'm a little bit amazed that the cell phone can link with Echo Link, and it's not the cell phone linking with IRLP. So there's some magic way that a cell phone can link with a node of Echo Link. Is that approximately what's happening? As you can tell, I'm not very well informed on the system, Rich. K2UPS, mobile, K2RIW.
I'm not that familiar with IRLP at all. I just know Echolink, and yes, I am coming in through my cell phone. But as far as I know, if you're accessing something through an RF link, like from an HT, from a repeater, say, in Minnesota, and you're linking back here to New York, that's going through IRLP. Echolink is going directly into the internet, either through a cell phone or through a laptop computer or something like that. At least that's my understanding. But I don't know how IRLP works.
Okay, your cell phone then is going through an internet link. Is there a fancy telephone number that you call that takes your voice and fits you on the internet, which in turn gets it into Echolink? Is that approximately how we're hearing you, Rich? Go ahead.
Well, there's the Echolink app that I'm running on the cell phone, or if you have a laptop or a computer, you'd be running Echolink software on it. And then you tell it to search for different Echolink stations, and you type in W2VL when it comes up, and you save it in a list. And then when you want to connect to W2VL, you open up the app or the program and go to the list of stations that you've saved. You click on it, and it does the connections. I'm not dialing any sort of numbers. I have no idea what the node numbers are. All I do is look for the call sign and click on it, and the app connects it all up.
Very nice. How did you find out about the stick, Rich? What reference were you using to find out how to do this? K2UPS, K2RIW?
I guess it was probably just other people talking about it, maybe articles in QST, that sort of stuff. And then when they had it on computers for a while, but when they started coming out with it on the cell phone, that's when I got more interested in it and did some research and found out what was involved. You know, it's really not that difficult. And once I put the app in the phone, it was pretty easy after that.
What's your guess as to the total number of people that you have talked to that are using a cell phone app to get into Echolink? Is that a little bit rare, or is there a whole lot of people, particularly on the Limock machine, doing it that way? And you've had this capability for, what, about a year now, Rich? K2UPS, K2RIW?
I've probably been doing it for at least two, maybe closer to 3 years. There's a lot of people locally that use it to both monitor the repeater, maybe at their work, or they just don't have a radio with them, or maybe they don't have a radio from their house that's strong enough to get into the repeater, so they just monitor it that way. But it is, I wouldn't say it's very common, but out of the people using Echolink, there's probably more cell phones doing it than laptops. And you can connect up with repeaters all over the United States and all over the world. So I've done that a few times, but mostly I just use it to keep in touch with my friends back in New York.
By the way that you're doing it, Rich, what's the greatest DX you've had so far? Did you just, out of curiosity, try somebody in Australia? Go ahead.
I've listened to stations like in Japan and that, but I've never spoke to anybody there. I have spoken to people in England and in Norway, but I've listened to other ones in other areas.
Good stuff. I can remember 15, 20 years ago when cell phones were just coming online, making a prediction on the TechNet that not too far from now, a person will be using his cell phone. He'll be looking at a beautiful sunrise in New Zealand, is what I think I used as an example. With the camera that's in his cell phone, he'll take a picture of that. He'll call up his friend in California, apologize for waking him up, saying, I'm witnessing this beautiful event, and I'd like you to see it, so I'm mailing you the picture. I was making that prediction all way back lots of years ago. Nowadays, things like that are pretty commonplace. So
I think computers, RF circuits, internet, the combination, internet of everything, IoT or whatever it's called. I suspect it's going to catch on. Now, Paul, I got one further question for you. Yes, it's a good experiment, this experiment going on in Hawaii. And I think you said it's a two-story structure where these people are going to be there for something like, is it 3 years? They're going to be making believe that they're on the surface of Mars for at least a year or two. Wow. So in other words, by some means, they're going to be thoroughly self-sustaining. They've got more than a year's supply of food inside that housing with them, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, it's supposed to be 36 feet in diameter. It's made out of vinyl. It looks like a big dome. No. This group is going to go for 8 months. There was NASA financed three missions. The first one was for 4 months. That was done a while back. And then now this one for 8 months. And then one more after all of this will be 1 year. But I mean the goal is, you know, they're thinking if to go to Mars and back, you know, you're looking at probably a 3 year time period. So that's what they're dealing with. I think they call it high seas, HISEAS, probably an acronym for something. But I'll have to look that one up. And they want to see how their personalities and everything work out. I assume they have tons of food in this. I'm not sure exactly how they're going to handle the food situation. And they want to see how they react with each other. I think that's more of a psychological test than anything else. See how people could handle being in close quarters with one another for such a long period of time. Yeah, it's different than a biosphere, too. They're 3.5 acres, eight people. But these people are really crammed on top of one another if you look at the little facility that they're in back there.
Yeah, the previous one was trying to manufacture their own food by solar input to, let me call it their greenhouse that they were living in. I presume High Seas is not intending to manufacture any of the consumables. And it's an interesting experiment, but if I wanted to be critical, I can ask the question, what's the real advantage of putting a human being on Mars as opposed to something like Curiosity? And the cost to put a human being with all the sustainables on Mars, I'm going to make a rough guess that it's well above $1 trillion in 2014 money. Maybe it's even $2 or $3 trillion, but it's a big number. I don't think any one nation can support it. It's going to have to be a consortium of Western nations to come up with the funds. And those nations, you know, taking a big chunk of their gross national product and putting it into this project, they're going to ask the question, what do I get for my money? What do I get in return? So if I wanted to be awfully negative and critical and I asked that question, do you think there's a good answer to that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, rocks.
Plenty of rocks. I always thought it would have to be international, and we've had plenty of practice, 16 countries involved with the International Space Station, $100 billion project, and that's a lot of money. And what do you get from it? Well, the first person that stands on the planet, it's going to be big plus for whatever country that is. So you send an international group, it'll help. But the second person that goes down, you know, it'll be the first person from whatever country they're from, you know, so it's always that way. The next mission up to the International Space Station, you have three more people going up. I guess probably a couple of months from now, and they'll be have the first Italian woman. Now she'll come back to Italy. First Italian woman astronaut. There's been an Italian man, you know. So the first of something. It always makes it's newsworthy. Is there going to be science? I guess just like the Apollo mission. So much science has been developed over the years from the space, you know, all the different countries from the space missions that we've all had. A real return? I don't know. We got to go out to that planet that's made of diamonds somewhere. I remember reading about that. Maybe that'll help. That'll be a good return on your money.
Jay's the end of the comment.
Yeah, I'm not so sure you get a good return on your money. It's time we go over to Wes, and I see that you've got a number of nuclear sources, and you've got your Ortec device looking at them, and I'm going to make a guess that you're getting ready to repeat the Coleman experiment. Is that true, Wes? In 2XJN, K2RIW?
One second, Wesley. It's called High Seas. I found the acronym. If you want to look it up, Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation. So that's what it stands for. Sorry about that, Wesley. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine. Go ahead, Wes.
Actually, the comment about Space Report was that a moon is made from the same material as the Earth. It is being considered that in the early time there was a collision between two planets, and a part of that dripped out and created the moon. But the gravitation field didn't allow that to go further, and that's how we got a moon. So one of the assumptions is that there was found an enormous amount of viable material on the moon. However, if that was to be eventually sent to Earth, it would create devaluation of, let's say, gold. Let me jump. Okay. But it's just one of the notions from the science. If you go to email from October 25, yeah, you see on the first picture you see Ortec. This is Detective EX. This one has a color display and is fully loaded with anything the Homeland Security needs to be there. It does have a base station. The base station has a post, and that post has a weak cesium-137 calibration source, so everything is there. And it's operated on the Stirling engine, which for some people could be surprised how come the Stirling engine is being used for cooling. I have a lot of information about it. Then on the third picture, you see the USB connections, three of them, actually two of them, and one for the headset if you want to, but it does have a built-in speaker. And the next one is showing the screen, the color screen. It shows the peaks. So the major difference between high-purity germanium detectors and scintillating detectors like sodium iodide with thallium is that those are very sharp, the peaks representing particle nuclide. Particular isotope. And if you use a high-purity germanium detector, you would be able to actually see all of the energy peaks of the particular isotope, but if you use sodium iodide, you might simply miss them, because it's more like a Gaussian curve. It's not necessarily Gaussian curve, but it's similar to this one. But let me show you cesium 133 calibration source, and then you see on the screen recognition. The recognition comes very quickly, within 3 seconds. I see it happen. And then you see on the search mode, it's actually the spectrum that is based on the strength of the signal that is moving from left, from right to left side, and you see the hidden presence of the radioactive isotope in the in that cloud. And on the next one, you see multiple sources. You have a cesium-137, manganium-54, which are shown on the display, and then on the last one, you see one that is cesium-137 a pulse, and the one that I'm holding in my hands, which is manganium-54, next to the high purity germanium detector of that unit. And to exit.
In that picture where it says digging for hidden spectrum of multi-source, that shows us as a weak red line in the middle of all those strong blue lines. Is that using something like digital signal processing to look for that particular spectral signature, Wes? Go ahead.
No, it's a simple signal strength. Like you saw in the first one, that was atypical sodium iodide, actually it wasn't sodium iodide, but scintillating detector. That one has a mode that allows you to measure the energy level of the isotope. So you would be able to see, let's say, how close you are or how far you are from the probe and the isotope. But this one has also the same features. I didn't switch in here on pattern of the recognition, but rather trying to see a various strength of the number of the isotopes that were measured. So at that point, you could actually find a pinpoint where that isotope is there. And then on the last one, you see the recognition of this. So actually on the picture, when you have a blue line, you see two lines. One line is responsible for cesium-137, the other one is for manganium-54.
And I see that you've got a cryogenic cooler in that Ortec detector, which doesn't require liquid nitrogen. Is that a Peltier effect cooler, or is that a small refrigerator system? What's your guess as to how that cooling takes place, Wes Grant?
It doesn't use LN2, which is liquid nitrogen. It has a miniature high reliability, let's say, run forever Stirling engine, and that one doesn't use liquid nitrogen at all. Does have a relative efficiency about 40%. I can go to it, but before that, some features that this thing does. It's mostly made for nuclear materials, but also for emergency response and corrosion product monitoring whatsoever. It does industrial, medical, natural, nuclear, and it does have a group for it. So, let's say cobalt 57, cobalt 60, barium 133, cesium 137, iridium 192, americium 241, or selenium and so on. Those are the industrial ones. But you could go to uranium, and then, surprisingly to you guys, you can find number of radioactive sources in your houses. Those are not harmful ones, but they are ever present. One of them is K40, potassium 40, ever present in salt, 226 radium, and actually radium has a 3 energy level. and I was measuring this thing is so enormously sensitive. You leave it for 24 hours, and you're gonna see a long list of what you have there. So it ran for me molybdenum plus TC99M, which is technetium 99M, which looks like the medical technetium, but actually it is due to the process of transmutation and changing itself to the daughter product. And sometimes some of those short-living isotopes are living in nanoseconds, milliseconds, and then they decay to more of them. Then I took another picture of what I have there, and I found like six or seven of them, which technetium 228 is mostly present if you guys have a granite or a slate tiles on the floor. Tiny grain of natural uranium, and then you see in it presence of actually it's uranium-235, which is nuclear, but this thing is so smart, it shows you that it's not nuclear, it's suspect nuclear, which is the commercial military grade. That is a product of change. So there are plenty of things that are now coming back to the Stirling engine. That's interesting because cryogenic cooling normally is required for the germanium and silicon semiconductor photon radiation detectors, and in order to support different counting geometries, they use a wide range of cooling options. So they use liquid nitrogen, sometimes helium, but they switch right now the technology that's the new trend to electromechanical coolers. And also, before I go to that, this thing gives you also warnings. So it's so far nothing found, or consistent with background keep counting, or says count rate consistent with background elevated radiation, possible beta emitter and unknown gamma. So it's not only gamma, it says that we may have also positron emitter or medical positron emitter or nuclear material. Now, Homeland Security made a special request from the manufacturer to give it foolproof. That means that chances for mistake or false alarm is extremely small one. If it says found nuclear uranium, it not only gives you the message, but also gives you the isotope energy level and certainty of what you have. It could also tell you that you have highly enriched uranium, or depleted uranium, or low enriched uranium, or natural uranium, or elevated uranium concentration. Also, polonium. I found polonium. Polonium. So I was so far puzzled with that, and I found that polonium is actually very widely distributed in small amounts in the Earth crust, it can be produced by chemical processing of uranium as well, but mostly is due to the decay of uranium-238, which is very present. So it would be interesting for you if I come to your house one day and find out what you have in your house and to it. thing is not picking up, so I'm going to continue with the Sterling engine. The Sterling engine that is used there is not Grumman pulse to cooler. And it does have a balanced compressor. It's a very small device. Usually it's maintenance free, is made from anywhere from 50,000 hours to 200,000 hours continuous operation, so it's extremely reliable. And one could ask, how come the Sterling engines could be used for cooling? So, Dick, I wonder if you know that. Like Dick went for the moment. The Sterling refrigerator is made of the piston, sometimes called displacer. And according to the Gauss law, during the repeated Gauss explosions, expansions, the heat is repeatedly absorbed and expanded from thermally isolated surroundings, and making it colder. So that would be compression and decompression. That's one of the ways that is being used, but there are plenty of other ways to use that as the cooler. So that would be most of it. One more thing is that that also allows me to use a different form of energy dispersive X-ray spectroscopy, which I was doing with X-rays before, to find out almost every periodic table component in, let's say, a piece of dirt that I took from the street, or let's say the ring that I have on my hand. That could be done due to a neutron spectroscopy, similar to EDXRF, that one used the X-rays knock out one of the electrons from the K shell, which is the closest one to the nucleus, and then create the series of displacements, and by that emitting photons, and those photons are measured, characteristic to something, to periodic table components. And here with, say, Californium 252, if those neutrons heat any matter, not radioactive matter, they create gamma photons. Those are also characteristic, and that's how that sort of EDXRF could be done. And to here. Back to the car.
Yep. I got called away. Sorry for a minute. Your next experiment, is it possibly going to be similar to Coleman, or there's some other experiments you'll be doing in between here and there, west?
No, I'm working on Coleman. I'm very much positive of what I'm getting as a result of it. And I see the manifestation of energy being released, and I see the conversion happening. So for that, I see a lot of basis to claim that this device works. The set of devices is mostly curiosity and fascinating, because I'm getting deeper into the nuclear structure and the matter and changes of the matter. And you could see the chain of the reaction when you go to nuclear elements. Those are nanoseconds, milliseconds, and then you see that gondolium 159 that I found in that small sample of uranium, natural uranium, is only 18 hours lifetime, I mean a half-life, and it's made from europium, and europium is probably 8 minutes, if I remember correctly. So, but it starts from the decay schemes, parasodinium, and parasodinium has a lifetime 10 milliseconds. So, it's interesting. Enjoy here.
The detector assembly has, I think you said, it's a Stirling engine to make the cryogenic temperature. I guess that's to keep the detector very sensitive so it doesn't have random noise. And if it was liquid nitrogen temperature, that would be 77 Kelvin. Did any of the instructions tell you what temperature that detector maintains with that Stirling engine, Wes? Go ahead.
Approximately minus 209 Celsius.
Okay, 209 from 270 is, under 77 degrees Kelvin, isn't it? Yeah. So it's even colder than liquid nitrogen. When that Stirling engine is running, do you hear it running? Does it make a sound?
Yes, it does make a sound, but you got to be extremely close to hear it.
Yeah, the stand that detector is mounted in has two fans, so I would guess air is continuously circulated through the heat exchanger of that Stirling engine. Is that true?
No, it is not. See, they had a problem. Because the device is broken, approximately 18 and a half kilogram. Although they list that as a 13 kilogram device, which would be 26 pounds, is 18 and a half kilogram. And it does have a distant future, which is neutron detection. You cannot start it normally from the internal battery. It's not going to start because it's not enough of energy. So you got to have to have a base station with two fans. And of course, those two fans are for cooling electronics in the base station, but also helping to cool the bottom where the Stirling engine is. But then it's completely independent. So that means that you could disconnect the cables and operate the device for 3 hours from the internal battery. I was lucky because that device, although the lease price is $92,000, for it is in pristine condition and the battery was never put inside. There is no sign that the battery was ever there. When I unscrewed the plate was painted with the original paint for it. So this device was standing somewhere in the lab. And from the information I found that originally came from Sandia and to Etria.
Interesting. You think they sold it because they ended up with something that's better?
Well, they have another one, and that one is Microdetective. Microdetective has the same program, works exactly the same. It doesn't have better performance, but is 40% lighter than Detective EX. It's 50% reduction in overall size. Is also simple to operate. Well, I didn't see any difference between both of them. I touched both of them. But it has a built-in neutron detector. The only difference is that the micro detective has a coaxial high-purity germanium detector where you have inside inserted a neutron detector, which I don't believe is good because that one that I have, which is external, is right below the high-purity germanium detector, is much, much more sensitive. And to actually, a minute, Dick.
What do you believe is going to be your next experiment with this instrumentation, Wes? Go ahead.
Finish it, Coleman.
command and releasing it to the public. Enter a shield.
Okay, that's quite a task. You guys have heard technet number 1527 of the series. I'm still amazed that it's lasted this long. 73, you all. Thank you for your contributions. And over to you, John. And I know you've gotten some recent new instrumentation, so lots of test equipment has just been added to your laboratory. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yes, very true, Dick, and more on the way. But I want to thank everybody for joining the net tonight, and if everything goes well, we shall appear again next Sunday, same time. And I'll let you know how the equipment goes, Dick. KC2WGB, clear.
Yeah, you've got a brand new network analyzer that really is a vector network analyzer. It's got a time domain reflectometer to it. It's got a bunch of directional couplers, and you've got even more coming. Your laboratory doesn't have enough equipment. If you counted all the things that you own in that laboratory, it must be a pretty big number, John.
Well, if I count the ones that I have in storage, it's over 1,000. I have maybe close to 100 here.
Wow. You are a collector. Good luck with all that. Bye-bye, you all. KQLA to be clear.
Good night, Dick, Paul, everyone. KC2WGB, clear.
He didn't say the truth. He has a few thousands, or only hundreds in his lab.
And that's what I heard him say. Those are big numbers by my standards.
I want to roll. I want to roll every piece of equipment out there.
Hey, he says, just open up the Hewlett-Packard catalog and say, send me one of each one of those.
Yes, and I will pay you next week for them. Good night, all.
Thank you very much, Dick. I wish you the best, and thank you very much to everybody.
Sure, but I know that when it goes out or we have trouble with the RF, the Echolink system.